Welcome again to the Cannabis Investing Podcast, where we speak with C-level executives, scientists, and law and sector experts to provide actionable investment insight and the context with which to understand the burgeoning cannabis industry. I'm your host, Rena Sherbel. Hi again, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Great to have you listening. As always, welcome to the 101st episode of the Cannabis Investing Podcast. Today, really happy to have Scott Hammond on. He is the partner and leader of the cannabis practice at MGO, which is a national cannabis practice, and he gets into what MGO does and how they made their name. And he has a lot to say. They just released a report recently about M&A trends in the cannabis industry. Certainly, we're on the cusp of a new trend, according to Scott, and we can see that playing out, the new kinds of M&As that are developing. Not the M&As of last year, certainly not the M&As of 2 years ago or the promised M&As of a year and 2 years ago. More responsible, you know, we've been talking on this podcast for a while to find the responsible players in cannabis. There are so many companies to look at, but the ones really worth investing in are not necessarily the ones with the flashy headlines, although sometimes they are. But the ones that are being responsible stewards of capital, which if you are a listener of the show, know we love to support fiscal responsibility. So Scott gets into that and talks about the further maturation of the cannabis industry that we're in. We get into some topics like beverages in the cannabis space, how COVID has been an accelerator of trends that were already present, both in the cannabis space and more broadly. And we get into the Canada space and what Scott thinks about that and when companies should be going public and the trends that we're seeing there and what companies are deciding to do and what they should be deciding to do. Obviously, not a one-size-fits-all approach, but Scott gets into some reasons where companies are deciding where and when to go public. A great conversation about the state of the cannabis industry and things to be looking for coming up. Obviously, so much news related to the cannabis industry. Lots of promises and excitement, not all of them coming to fruition. And as I saw a former guest of this podcast, Dr. Jessica Knox, speak about all of these legal measures. Some of them are great, some of them aren't going to happen. But whatever does happen, it really doesn't mean much when there's so many people without access and who are still sitting in jail, people still going to jail for these cannabis offenses. So when we are talking about all the excitement out there, you know, really important to keep in mind all the components that go into that, not just as investors, but as good investors and supporting the industry maturation in the right way. Something Scott and I also discussed briefly in this conversation. So excited to get this interview to you guys and excited about the interviews we have coming up. Next week, we have Nicholas Vita from Columbia Care, an interview I've been promising you guys for a few weeks. Excited to get that out. We have Saul Kay, our very first guest, going back to our roots on the podcast, catching us up on the Israel cannabis scene, which is very promising right now and has a lot of exciting things coming down the pike. We're going to get into what all that means and what investors can look for there. And followers of the show, you and I are both excited, hopefully, about our second episode, our second part of our master class investing in cannabis, back with James Baker and Julian Lin. James Baker doing some great work on Facebook, being an activist shareholder on Liberty Health. If you want to check that out, we get into that and other topics for cannabis investors. You don't want to miss it. Part one was great. Part two, I imagine, will be even greater. And get me any points and questions and topics you want us to cover, and hopefully we can get to that. Thanks, as always, for listening. Thanks again for your comments, your participation. And as I tweeted a couple weeks ago, Ido, a longtime listener of the show, published his first couple cannabis articles on Seeking Alpha to much, much fanfare, really great pieces on, you know, some of the cannabis legislation. And another request for anybody out there who writes who wants to write about the cannabis industry, who wants to have their voice be heard in the hallways of Seeking Alpha and in the broader internet atmosphere. We would love to have you. Please get in touch with me. It's Rena, R-E-N-A, plus the plus sign, C-A-N-P-O-D, at SeekingAlpha.com. Would love to hear from you. And before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice of any sort. And in my model cannabis portfolio, I am long Trulieve, Chiron, Grow Generation, Curaleaf, Vireo Health, and Isracan Biosciences. You can subscribe to us on Libsyn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Stitcher. Scott, welcome to the Cannabis Investing Podcast. Really happy to have you on the show. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Rena, it's my pleasure, and thanks for having me.
So I like to start out by asking guests where they started and how they arrived to the cannabis industry. So do you want to give listeners your version of that journey?
Sure. It may be a little bit different origin story than some of your other guests. I'm a partner here with MGO, where I lead our cannabis practice, and MGO works with a lot of different industry groups, but one of those industry groups is state and local government. And the firm has a lot of offices in California. And as a firm, we got into the space initially through insights from our government practice. They were working with cities in California, which had tax regimes, and those cities were coming to our government practitioners, raising questions about whether they were getting their fair share of the tax revenue that they were under their local cannabis tax jurisdiction setups. And so that made us, the rest of us, aware that there was a real business here, that this was a growing industry. We started to dip our toe in the water, and we were fortunate enough that one of our first relationships was to do an audit of a vertically integrated operation in the Bay Area that was being acquired by what was to become the first plant-touching public company in the U.S. The industry was so small, the number of people playing in the space were so small, that when that document got filed and our name was associated with it, it really gave us a lot of prominence early on, and we benefited from that. So from that start about 6 years ago, we've been able to grow dramatically, and that's how the firm came to the space. For me personally, I got involved. I have prior experience. I grew up, I was born in 64, so I grew up in a time when, cannabis was popular, and certainly I partook at the appropriate time in my life. And I grew up in an area that was semi-rural and growing was common. So I had friends that grew and so forth. Famously, one of my friends took a basic ag science class in high school so they could improve yields and production. So I've been involved with it in some form for quite some time.
Nice. Did you ever think that you would get to this side of things?
No, I mean, I think when I first got involved with that initial transaction, it was, okay, I'll do this, but this is going to be a niche thing. It's a California thing. It's a West Coast thing. And at that point, if you had asked me that the industry would evolve as quickly as it had, as would grow as rapidly as it had, and evolve as fast as it has, I would have said you were kidding. I was fortunate enough to be part of the dot-com boom in the late 90s, and that's the only other thing. I really should say the tech boom in the late 90s. Dot-com was more early 2000s, but that's the only thing I can equate this to. And there's a core difference in that the tech industry was at a higher level of maturity from start. Cannabis really started from ground zero, and everything had to be built. Everything from tax regimes, regulatory regimes, industry operations, et cetera, et cetera. So the pace has been breathtaking. It's been exciting, and it's been wonderful to be part of.
You know, this was on something I wanted to ask you about. I wasn't going to ask you now, but I feel like it dovetails nicely into what you just mentioned. I'm curious, do you think that there's a unifying thread between who is more successful in the cannabis industry? In other words, do you think that it behooves people that have come from the law field, that have come from a finance background, more than, let's say, somebody that's coming from the legacy cannabis market or, you know, the oil and gas sector or something else? Do you think there's something specifically that helps people succeed?
I think, like with any industry, as the industry goes through its own life cycles, there's probably a greater demand for certain skill sets than at other times. And so certainly in cannabis, we've seen, as the industry's matured, more demand for people coming from other industries with what I'll call more traditional skill sets to be able to apply those skill sets to that stage of cannabis's evolution. Having said that, I think the one core principle that's is necessary in an industry like cannabis that's growing so rapidly and is evolving and is touching so many areas, whether regulatory, operational, et cetera, is being flexible, being creative, being innovative, and the ability to look ahead and have a thought process and be able to implement that thought process based on unknown factors. Some people are uncomfortable. I think in some, you have to be comfortable being uncomfortable to succeed in this industry. That's probably the core thing, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. And the ability to be nimble, as you said. So MGO recently released a report on cannabis, talking mostly about mergers and acquisitions within the industry. And you write about how, you know, we've kind of gone through the past 2 years, gone through this journey of there were all these promising headlines and deals being touted and M&As and a lot of excitement. You know, I remember being at conferences like around that time, and there was just a ton of excitement and a ton of talk, and a lot of those fell through. And I think the people that have seen a lot of the companies that have succeeded through that were a lot smarter with their capital, with their finances, didn't expand, you know, in a overwrought fashion. And so now you write that we're on the cusp of another burst of M&A, but one that's predicated on something a lot more grounded in, you know, fiscal responsibility. Do you want to talk to listeners about that kind of evolution or kind of return to a point in the wave and how this is working itself through the industry?
You know, absolutely. Great question. And it, I think it's something that's not uncommon for any industry that's growing so rapidly and maturing so quickly. And again, people have analogized what we've gone through in cannabis to the, you know, the tech boom of the 90s or the dot-com of the early 2000s. And there certainly are similarities. And one of those is that, as you initially said, yes, there is definitely a demand for a physical geographic presence, licensing, or revenue growth, and that was the be-all, end-all. And as we highlighted in the M&A guide, you know, over the last several months, certainly most of 2020, you've seen a focus on core operational success, whether it's EBITDA, positive cash flow, net income, et cetera. Those things are paramount now. And so we certainly have seen that return to normalcy. And we think that's an indicator, really, it's not a bad thing. We think that's an indicator of the maturation of the industry. And that's net a good for everybody, because it does put some realistic, pragmatic filters or governors on everything from pricing to making sure that the industry is sustainable in the long run.
So how do you see that shaping out, like on the heels of this election where, you know, a wide section of the successful companies are coming from the states, and especially the multi-state model? Do you think that they have an advantage, especially when you're talking about, you know, being able to pick up assets, especially distressed assets, you know, during this time? Do you think that there's an advantage there?
I think the advantage is less with any particular class of operator by size than, going back to your comment about certain characteristics. I think good operators will be able to take advantage of this current marketplace, regardless of whether they're one of the larger players, a medium-sized player, or a small niche player. Because the same issue you just highlighted, the potential ability in this next wave of consolidation to acquire potentially valuable licenses, assets for any operator, certainly it applies to a big MSO, but also applies to a smaller operator that maybe wants to expand in their current geographic location, even if it's as small as a city. So I think those opportunities are there for the good operators, whether they're big, little, or small. So we think those types of issues and the impact of M&A is going to be felt all up and down, you know, the value chain of cannabis, if you will, or the size parameters of cannabis.
And do you subscribe to the notion, like a lot of people do, that limited license states, they're more valuable just by the sheer nature of what it means to be limited?
I think that regulatory barriers do help to protect those that are in and maintain a steady level of a higher floor under those values. So I do think that's probably a truism. I do think as we see, and I'm not going to say national brands evolve, because I think we're away from that still happening. But I think as you see regional brands, which certainly you're starting to see regional brands, and I think one of the aspects of retrenching is people have given up the desire of having a true national footprint at this point. Most people, or many people, focusing more on having strong regional markets where they can have, you know, a bigger market presence. I think you're seeing that, you know, that regional brand start to take hold. And I think that's, you know, that's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
And do you think that gets doubled down, like now that the states that have passed, you know, I'm thinking like Harvest in Arizona, you know, it seems like they're going to be doing a lot better. The fact that it's gone legal, you know, TerrAscend is one example, Curaleaf in New Jersey, you know, there's a lot of examples, right, of companies able to double down on that. Do you think that just pushes that theory forward even more so?
I do. But I also think that even for good operators, you know, I think that if you agree that maybe, you know, we've gone from having a pure national goal, as many people started with 3 years ago, to having a strong regional footprint, I think the next evolutionary step of that, and you've already seen it, this is, other people are already doing this, is not just a single regional footprint, but two or three regional footprints, if you will, you know, almost an island hopping strategy. And so I think what you'll see is you'll continue to see operators who have financial management and operating capital to do so, they will look to be expansion oriented, but in certain clusters. And so you might see somebody that's got a strong West Coast presence decide operationally they want to be in the upper Midwest, and they'll try and aggregate two or three states or more in the upper Midwest. And they may even go into that market around not their core West Coast brand. They may develop an entirely new upper Midwest specific brand, or they may leverage one of their acquisitions and build around that, or some combination. I think that's one of the more fascinating evolutions, as I mentioned, is, you know, and we're working with clients right now, they're making determinations. They may have a very geographic focused brand as they move into other regions. Do they try and transplant that brand cachet, or do they build off a more, you know, regionally logical brand? You know, things like that. So I think those are some, you know, the industry continues, even though it's reached a new stage of maturation. There's just so many new and interesting issues that the industry has to work through. I think, you know, branding and how it plays is one of them, certainly.
And do you think that depends on, you know, the company itself in terms of deciding what to do based on the geographic location, like how much to tweak their formula? Is that just dependent on the specifics?
It does. You know, I think, you know, we've always said that cannabis is an aggregation of multiple industries, and one of them is kind of a CPG retail, you know, type approach. And so you see those same kind of issues that a traditional CPG company would be faced, right? Do I want to export a brand, a lifestyle, and bring that with me? Or do I want to leverage off a localized, you know, more regionally focused for that region and change my brand and build off of it? And it gets interesting too, because I think before we get to full federal legalization, if and when we get to that point, with, you know, interstate commerce and so forth, you know, there's been some discussion about whether we're going to get to a place where regional compacts come into existence, and whether we'll have to see 2, 3, 4 states come together and allow, you know, interstate commerce among those states. And that's going to drive some of these questions as well. And so, you know, there are people far smarter than me that are thinking about these things. And I suspect some of those are driving some of those decisions, both about physical expansion as well as branding issues and so forth.
Do you see it as an issue of kind of like these clusters developing and then they kind of just like keep spreading out until it's all just one big mass?
Yeah, I do. I do think that it's almost analogous to how legalization has gone, right? It's gone, you know, started in certain very specific states and kind of a western region established itself, and then other places in the northeast or southeast were footprints. If you look at Florida, it was the first, you know, southeastern state to really go in a major way. And now, of course, you're seeing other states in the region start to come along. So I think you are going to see that kind of process or evolution.
And how much do you think it affects like how companies are, or I should say in terms of like the retail picture specifically, like how much COVID has affected things? Obviously, these questions about intercommerce, you know, retail, like they are affected too, but primarily COVID has been such a disruptor in the retail picture. And a lot of people have innovated ways around that and really made it work for them. But I'm curious, do you see a lot of companies kind of rethinking their scope of focus and maybe pivoting away from the retail picture? Or, yeah, go ahead.
No, it's an interesting question, because a lot of times we talk about cannabis, when we talk about the industry, sometimes we're talking about national issues, other times we're talking about very state-by-state issues, because again, each state is evolving at its own pace based on when it adopted a program, whether that program is just pure medical, whether it was medical evolving to recreational, or whether it's always been recreational for day one. And so it's hard to answer that question across a national answer. But clearly COVID affected retail, and going back to our earlier comment, you know, those people that were comfortable being uncomfortable, nimble, were able to pivot faster. And it's been talked about much, you know, the fact that most states declared cannabis to be an essential industry certainly helped, but even there were restrictions, whether it was, you know, curbside delivery mandates, delivery only mandates, take your pick. You know, retailers had to be flexible and nimble to adjust. I think most of them have done a pretty good job. Because they're still a relatively new industry, still a relatively new supply chain. So people are used to pivoting and navigating around a changing environment. I think that was a skill set that was very helpful during COVID. But the other part of what you're asking is really a broad question about the future of retail in a way. And I'm not a retail expert, but I can read like yourself and others. And certainly I think, you know, we've seen malls really take a massive hit even before COVID, but even more with COVID. And I think the traditional retail model, with a few exceptions, is going to be challenged post-COVID. I think what COVID, as many people have said, has probably accelerated by 5 or 10 years processes that were probably already underway and were going to happen gradually. COVID's accelerated, you know, that. So I wouldn't say that retail is dead. I would never say that. I think there's always going to be a place for it. But I do think that, you know, cannabis operators will be looking at rapid evolution in their retail concepts, you know, going from a traditional storefront. And you've already seen it with some companies, you know, Planet 13 famously in Las Vegas, to an entertainment driven, I'll call it, or a social experience model. And then, you know, the further evolution down the road a little bit is, when and if cannabis is mainstream into traditional retail channels, what does that do to that standalone dispensary? But again, even then, that's not a national issue. If you look at somebody that's a medical only state and stays medical, then that retail model continues to work. So again, I think cannabis operators are until such time as we have full federal legalization, I'm not sure that's going to happen in my professional career. Until that happens, you know, they're going to have to operate in different retail environments, and each of those environments will dictate a different retail strategy.
You're not sure that federal legalization is going to happen in your professional career?
Yeah, as you can tell, we're on a Zoom call today. You can tell there's a fair amount of gray, so that may not be a long runway. But, you know, I do think that, and I analogize to sports betting, I'm not sure how familiar you are with that, but that was something that, you know, with the Supreme Court ruling on that about 2 years ago, it allowed states to decide. And so I'm not sure, given the political environment in the U.S., that full legalization, meaning legal every state, you know, subject to the same rules of interstate commerce, et cetera, is going to happen in the near term. I do think we're going to see some version of states' rights as at least an interim step before we get there. And it may be the permanent step that, you know, we operate in. It may always be a states' right kind of marketplace.
And do you think if it goes that way, like they get rid of things like the 280E and they take away those kind of onerous regulations and leave it in some kind of murky in-between state?
I do think that a murky in-between state is, you know, there's multiple outcomes, an infinite number of outcomes. But I do think that's probably one of the more likely outcomes. And I would hope, because of the impact that banking access and 280E has on the industry, that, you know, that with that would come relief. And I think when you talk to many people in the industry, and there's different opinions about this, but some people would argue, well, hey, before we try and fight for full legalization, let's get 280E off the books. Let's get access to banking and capital. So, you know, there's some people that argue that's more important in the near term than full federal legalization.
Right. I mean, look, there's a whole host of issues that people feel like are more important than federal legalization, right. just stamping that, you right. know?
And even as we were talking about that, you know, I'm an accountant, I'm a business person. I tend to focus on finance and accounting, but you know, everybody in this industry in particular, but even more broadly, you know, I'd be remiss if we didn't highlight that, you know, issues other than 280E or banking that are out there related to social justice, you know, expunging of criminal records, you know, making sure that our drug laws reflect, you know, a practical reality of what works best for society. And I think we can all agree that we probably don't have that situation now, and there's got to be progress made in those areas. And that's equally important, or maybe more important than some of the things I talked about in the long run.
Yeah, absolutely. And something we've been talking about on this podcast has been, even when those social equity components are developed and are, you know, implemented into legalization for a state, like in Illinois, for instance, it's such a long process until it's truly, truly implemented, if it even ever is right. implemented as it was, you know, thought that it would be. You know, and then I was reading somebody's writing about New Jersey and how it's legal and everybody's so excited and everybody, you know, all of this bullishness, but you can still get busted for cannabis in New Jersey, and that's crazy, you know, like. It's just a crazy, crazy ecosystem that is happening right now.
But it's one that's pretty consistent for cannabis, right? If you look at cannabis history, it's an issue where the reality on the ground frequently lags behind the discussions in the media or the pitches for new company, you know, capital raises, or you know, the buzzwords are out there, and that's just because it's moving so quickly that, you know, it takes a while for reality to catch up for what's possible and what's being discussed.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a nice way of looking at it. It's moving so quickly. It's tough for reality to catch up. Yeah. That's great. So talk to me a little bit about like how you are advising companies in this, you know, in this moment in time, in terms of capital that's out there, in terms of companies looking to merge or be acquired or acquire. I'm also interested in how much a company that maybe hasn't been doing well, or maybe didn't know, weren't the best stewards of capital at the beginning, and it took a while for them to figure it out. Do you see instances of companies like that merging with another company, or being acquired, and kind of that unified entity kind of builds it to be successful in a way it wasn't by itself?
Yeah, I'll maybe answer your last question first, which is we are seeing instances of that. And in some cases, tying into your first question, that's advice we're giving. So we're seeing situations where you may have an operator, a company that's got great assets, but they, for whatever reason, just haven't been able to pull the right management team into place to fully leverage those assets. On the other hand, we may have a client or be aware of a company that has a great management team, but maybe is capital constrained, haven't been able to raise capital, or their assets aren't well positioned. And so we'll talk to those entities and see if there's an opportunity to bring them together and leverage the strengths of both sides and have one and one plus, you know, make three. So, you know, you definitely see that. And I think you're going to see more of that as we move into this stage of consolidation in M&A, you know, the you know, 2 years ago was all about size and getting big footprints and so forth. And now you're seeing, I think, more selective M&A happening. As part of that, people are doing different deals for different purposes at different time frames. So you're seeing a wide range of deals for a wide range of reasons. When you look at the advice that we're talking to both clients and non-clients about, in the area of M&A or capital raising, you know, I guess I would say there's a couple of broad themes. In the area of capital raising, there's good news, bad news. The good news is that you're seeing, with the evolution, you're seeing some more traditional sources of capital come in. And so, for example, you know, we're talking to commercial lenders, commercial banks that are starting to dip their toe in the water to do traditional loans to cannabis operators. 2 years ago, you just didn't see that by and large. It's still relatively small, but it's real, it's out there, and it's going to continue to grow. And I think that's very exciting for the industry because it allows operators to develop a more traditional capital structure, one that includes both equity and debt. Historically, this industry was disproportionately funded solely with equity. And that's a real expensive way to go. And when the market moves against you or when values drop, it can be very difficult to navigate and maintain your expansion plans or your operational plans. So that's an exciting, very positive development. We're also seeing in small numbers, additional, you know, family offices, high net worth individuals and investment funds come into the space. That's good. The bad news is that without federal legalization, there still are large numbers of traditional institutional investors that would normally fund a rapid growth industry like this that either are factually constrained by the terms of their operating agreements to the fund itself, or they are philosophically constrained, where they just don't want to try and navigate or have to deal with fighting their, you know, explaining to their limited partners why they're getting into the industry. Again, that's getting better, but there still is a big chunk of traditional private equity, institutional capital that just is not available to deploy in the space. And that's the bad news. And that is the downside of not having federal legalization in place currently.
Do you think, like, as you said, it's getting a little bit better when you're talking about institutional mm-hmm. capital coming into the markets, like we just saw the Green Thumb deal. Do you think with each deal, it maybe inspires a different, you know, entity to get into the game?
Absolutely. I think, you know, everyone that comes in, it's accretive, right? And it's like a scale. And at some point, the scale will tip and it will weigh down on the side of more in than not. And when that happens, I think it becomes a game changer even without federal legalization. There's no question that each one that comes in is beneficial because that fund has both personal and professional relationships with 5 or 10 other funds or investors. And some percentage of those other 5 or 10, if they're not already in cannabis, will look at that fund's actions and will change their decision. It's not going to be 90% of them, but even if, you know, 20%, a quarter of them make that decision, then again, you're bringing along 2 or 3 other funds and they have that same. I'm old enough to remember the Clairol commercials of, you know, where they just replicate time and time again. So it's the same multiplier effect.
Gotcha. So when you're talking about, you know, companies looking towards the future and trying to figure out, what they want to look like or what path they want to go in order to achieve what they're looking to achieve, how kind of far into the future do you think it's wise to be looking out or do you advise companies to be looking out? Because so many things can change. Like even if we're just talking about the retail picture, for instance, are we looking 5 years out? Are you looking 2 years out? Because I imagine those are two like completely different things. And so much of it is hard to predict.
I think the answer, and not to be flippant, the answer is yes. So in this industry, we talked about an industry that's moving rapidly, evolving quickly. You have to look short term, medium term, and long term. And I think if you're an operator that doesn't have a strategy or a thesis for each of those, you're in big trouble. And that's what we talk to our clients about. Because you have to have the ability to execute in the near term. That's what's driving current cash flow, allowing you to fund your more medium-term or long-term thesis and strategies. If all you do is focus on the short term, then you're going to be caught unawares and the markets will evolve and leave you in the dust. So again, necessary to execute on all three levels.
And, you know, we're an investing podcast. So is your advice, you know, there's a lot of investors looking at the space now. There's a ton of bullishness with all the bullish factors that came out of the elections and, you know, really widespread support for cannabis, which brings about, you know, huge soars in some cannabis stocks. And there's a bunch of companies that are soaring that maybe I would advise listeners not to buy. But a lot of investors are buying those stocks. What do you say to investors who are looking at these, you know, entry points and getting really excited, but, you know, there's been some issues, you know, like a MedMen or an Ianthus or, you know, an Aurora. There's a whole host of examples that you could look at. What's your advice to investors there?
So first of all, a couple of points. You know, we don't make recommendations in our role. We would never recommend particular stocks, whether it's a client or non-client. And so, you know, I won't talk at this point about any specific companies. Having said that, I think this ties back into some of the things we commented on in the M&A guide. You know, the industry is at a point where core, good management, good operating results are very, very powerful. And those companies that can show that they can perform, meet expectations, you know, get to profitability, get to positive EBITDA, get to positive cash flows, those are the ones that, you know, I would say common sense dictates would have the longest survivability. They'll be the ones standing at the end of the game and more likely to be an acquirer and an adder of value versus somebody that's going to get acquired or go out of business potentially.
And you're only advising U.S. companies, is that right?
No, we work with, I mean, while most of our clients are U.S., we work with Canadian-based companies as well. Many, and again, you know, with the interesting structure of U.S. and the limitations on the exchanges here, a lot of our clients have gone public, and we continue to work with Canadian public companies with operations in the U.S., so we're working with Canadian companies and U.S. companies. We also have a smaller number, but we do work with international cannabis operators as well. So we have a pretty broad footprint in the industry.
So what's your thoughts on, I guess, one, these are two separate questions, even though they both pertain to Canada, but one, kind of what's your take on the Canadian land? Well, let's leave it there for now. What's your take on the Canadian landscape? You know, there was bearishness, now there's more bullishness as they kind of work out the, retail space and the supply issues. What's your take there on Canada?
So first of all, I love Canada. Secondly, it's a relatively small marketplace with a large number of operators. And I think there's a reason that some of those operators have placed bets, if you will, on U.S. assets or are executing on strategies to migrate into the U.S. market at the appropriate time. And I'm talking about those that are listed on TSX, not the Canadian Stock Exchange listed, which can cross the border and so forth. So there are limitations. And so the Canadian companies have a more complicated environment, if you will, because those that are, if we're talking about the traditional large LPs in Canada, you know, they're having to navigate the Canadian market. They're trying to keep an eye on the U.S. or place bets on the U.S. market. Many of them are also navigating certain specific international markets. So that's a more complicated operating environment to be successful in. And so enough said.
Got it. And what's your advice to companies? You know, obviously a lot of them go public on the Canadian exchanges because of the mm-hmm. legality issues. How do you advise a company when to go public, when to go public on the Canadian exchange, if they should wait, to go onto the American exchanges? How do you advise companies there?
Yeah, a couple thoughts. Number one, we remain hopeful that regardless of federal legalization, we're hopeful that NASDAQ and NYSE will open up to the industry. And I hope they're willing to do that before full legalization for all the reasons I mentioned earlier. Secondly, the decision to go public primarily is a unique one and specific to every company. And there's not a one size fits all type of answer. And that's even on the basic decision of where to go public, much less which exchange to try and list on. What we are seeing, I'll just share some trends that we're seeing. So, a few years ago, really everybody in the U.S. that wanted to go public was listing on CSE. One, because of regulatory restrictions, and secondly, because of valuation metrics that, that exchange was seeing large valuation differentials over a comparable company that was only listed, let's say, on the OTC in the U.S. That gap has diminished, and it always varies by entity, but generally speaking, I would say that gap has closed by and large or diminished. So therefore, for U.S. operators, listing the OTC has become more attractive. Having said that, I think for any company, one, you have to make the decision whether it's appropriate for you to go public, and then the decision of where to list is a separate and secondary decision. And that may be transitory based on what the environment is at that point in time, because many of the companies that were U.S. operators that listed in Canada ultimately are also doing dual listings, and there's all sorts of strategies to get your exposure in both marketplaces over time. In terms of the bigger issue, which is, a company making a decision to go public, that's a decision that should not be taken lightly. That's the first thing we advise, clients, and we try to make sure that they are aware of the rigors that come with being a public company. And there are positives, but there are also downsides. And there are also other options, whether it's private capital because it exists, and they just need to be mindful of the pros and cons. And then, with SPACs, that's introduced a whole nother dynamic into the marketplace over the last, for cannabis anyway. I mean, obviously they've been around for a long time, but that's introduced yet another dynamic that gives companies another option.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Is there anything that you want to leave listeners with before we go and tell listeners how they can find you and MGO?
Sure. I appreciate the opportunity for a plug. So MGO, you can reach us at mgocpa.com. You can download various articles we have on the industry and content, including our most recent M&A field guide. I'm also reachable and available via the website and happy to take questions, comments, and always happy to engage in discussions about the industry. In terms of leaving thoughts for the listeners, just, you know, regardless of the ups and downs of cannabis at its core, what we have is a rapidly maturing, rapid growth industry that still has a lot of runway domestically and internationally. And that's a unique set of facts. And so you mentioned the investment focus of the podcast. I think there's a small number of industries that have ever met that criteria, much less meet it now. So it's certainly a unique opportunity. Having said that, because it's a regulated industry with multiple layers of facets to navigate, you know, good management teams will out, and having access to capital is important. And those would be two things I might keep in mind where I'm looking to invest in the space.
Yeah, good advice. Good advice. Sound advice. I want to ask you one question before I let you go. And that's, I'm curious what your take is on the beverage side of the market and how successful you think that's going to be. And maybe when.
Yeah.
And maybe when that's going to be successful.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been fortunate because we've been working in the infused beverage space now for several years, you know, because certain states have had very strong positions around it. So, you know, we do have a lot of experience in the space, but it's certainly coming to maturity. And this is one of the things of cannabis. It's not just a monolithic market. There's niches within the space, and certainly the infused beverage niche is starting to really take off in a major, major way. And certainly the Sweetwater transaction, you know, validates that theme or thought. So I see, you know, I think most predictions are that it will have disproportionately rapid growth relative to the industry as a whole. And certainly the beverage players, Constellation being the most famous, have been betting on that for a number of years. So I think we're going to continue to see that. And I think you're going to see it's part of that overall trend of more of a health and wellness approach to beverages. And I think cannabis and CBD fit well into that. So I think absolutely going to see more continued growth in that space. And it's a very exciting area.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the most exciting things about cannabis, and as you say, you know, like it's ready to grow exponentially. And I think there's so many areas that are known that it's going to grow in these areas. And then I think there's all these niche areas where even there's like niche within the niche. I think beverage market is one example of that. There's like, I mean, you can think of so many ways that cannabis is going to kind of like totally shift the paradigm there.
Correct. Because even the THC infused, excluding CBD, you know, you've got those that are focused on what I'll call the recreational experience, right? You have others that might be focused on a recovery or wellness approach to the beverage space, right? So even there, you're going to see two or three different you know, approaches, philosophies, and so it's going to be great for the investor and great for the consumer.
Yeah, absolutely. It's exciting. It's exciting. It's exciting to be a part of. It's exciting to talk about. Scott, I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your insights. Hope you come on again. This was a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for letting me join with you, and would love to chat again. Take care.
Thanks so much for listening to the Cannabis Investing Podcast. Subscribe or follow us on Seeking Alpha, Libsyn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or Stitcher. And we'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other investors find our show. If you have feedback or questions, we'd love to hear from you at rena+canpod@seekingalpha.com. That's rena+canpod@seekingalpha.com. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time.